Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service. I'm Rebecca Kesby in London, and in a moment we'll be joined by James Kamara-Sami in Wisconsin. Whatever happens as a result of today's election in the United States is going to be historic. Either Kamala Harris will become the first female US president and only the second president of mixed race, or Donald Trump will stage one of the only presidential comebacks in history and will become the first convicted felon to hold that office. Today, America decides and the whole world is watching. Such is the power and influence of the United States. It hasn't come cheap. $3.5 billion have been spent on advertisements alone. It's thought the overall cost of the races this time around is about $16 billion, making it the most expensive election cycle ever. Kamala Harris wrapped up her campaign with a final rally in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the biggest of the swing states that could determine the outcome of this election. She told supporters she was confident of victory, but that the race was not over yet.
Tonight, then we finish as we started, with optimism, with energy, with joy, knowing that we the people have the power to shape our future.
Well, the star-studded event was attended by Jon Bon Jovi, Katy Perry, Oprah Winfrey. Lady Gaga was the final act of the night, bringing the curtain down on the Harris campaign. She performed On the Edge of Glory. Well, Donald Trump was also in Pennsylvania last night in Pittsburgh, where he learned live on stage that he'd secured a celebrity endorsement that he'd been chasing.
Just getting this right now. So somebody that's very, very respected asked me to do his show 2 weeks ago, and I said, why not? And to me, it's very big because he's the biggest beyond anybody in a long time. And his name is Joe Rogan, and he's never done this before.
Mr. Trump then headed to one last stop in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he's ended all three of his presidential campaigns. And this was his message.
The presidency requires strength, courage, and grit. And in a little while, you have to stand up and tell Kamala that you've had enough. You can't take it anymore. You're destroying our country. You were a terrible vice president. You destroyed San Francisco. Kamala, you're fired. Get the hell out of here.
Well, for weeks, the polls have suggested that the presidential race is just too close to call. And that is exactly what's already happened in the tiny hamlet of Dixville Notch in New Hampshire, where there are only six registered voters who traditionally cast their ballots at midnight. It was an even split, three for Harris, three for Trump. Though, interestingly, of the six voters, four are registered Republicans. So someone switched sides. Let's head to another place where the polls have been very tight in this election so far, the swing state of Wisconsin, where we find our own James Kamara-Sami. James.
Yes, thanks very much, Rebecca. I'm just by Mequon City Hall in Ozaukee County. It's one of the counties just outside the city of Milwaukee, the biggest city in Wisconsin. And there are three suburbs. They have the acronym WOW, Ozaukee obviously being the O in WOW, which have trended Republican in the past, but during the Trump era have tended to see lower votes for the Republicans. It's part of the suburbs that the Democrats are hoping that they can make inroads in and do just enough to win this state. I'm just behind the City Hall, overlooking Homestead Highlanders baseball field. And at 7 a.m. a couple of hours ago this morning, Nancy, who's the presiding official inside the hall, shouted out, "Oh yay, welcome to the election," and the two dozen or so people who are waiting there could start voting. Now, she told us 70% of people had already voted in this district. That's pretty high. Of course, more than 80 million Americans have already voted. And she said that, you know, this is going pretty smoothly. Now, I spoke to a couple of people who were voting after they had cast their ballots. Asked one woman how important this election is.
It's important. I don't know if it's the most important in my lifetime. I still have a lifetime ahead of me.
Well, quite. You've got a bit behind yourself. I'm going to say that as someone who also has. So, may I ask how you voted?
Sure. Absolutely. Kamala all the way. There is no way Donald Trump can run this country again.
Why not?
Because he is not for the people. He is for himself. He is for the millionaires. He is not for women. He actually wants to move women back hundreds of years. And it would be very oppressive to have him president again. I lived through it 4 years, and it was a miserable 4 years to have his rhetoric all around us. It's a rhetoric of hate.
May I ask, have you always been a Democratic voter?
No, actually, I was raised in a Republican household, and in my younger years, I voted Republican. The party itself was changing, but, I mean, Donald Trump put the nail in the coffin. There's no doubt about that.
So you've just voted, have you?
Yeah, I have.
How was it?
It was good. It was my second time voting.
Can I ask you how you voted?
I voted Republican.
Okay, so you voted Republican. So all the way down the ticket, did you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And why?
So there's a few reasons. The main one, the border. During his 4 years, it was a lot better. Also, Donald Trump isn't against abortion like many people think. He wants to set limits, which I agree with. I don't feel like you can, abort a baby after it's born. But that's just personal preference.
That's interesting because a lot of women are saying, I'm voting for Kamala Harris because I think abortion's the number one issue, and you think it's a bit more nuanced.
I think that people have turned it into something that it's not. Never did Trump say that he's completely going to ban it. He's going to leave it up to the states. And if you don't like what your states have in policy, vote for something that you like. It shouldn't be a national issue.
Final question. How important is this election, do you think?
Pretty important. The last 4 years have been kind of rough. So it's kind of a big deal.
And Jamie, everyone's focusing on the top job, aren't they? The presidential race. But there's a lot more up for grabs today. We've got seats in the House and the Senate, of course. And then we need to explain the electoral college system, because that's going to be very important later on today.
How long have I got? About a minute for this from me.
You can do it.
It's big, isn't it? Yeah, look, the big picture is 270 electoral college votes are what either Donald Trump or Kamala Harris need to win the election. There are 10 electoral college votes up for grabs in this state. A lot of states, the election is already decided. We know how it's going to go. But Wisconsin, one of the seven or so that will decide where this goes. Yes, all seats in the US House of Representatives are up, a third of the Senate, third of the governor's races as well. So, as you say, a lot going on up and down the ticket. We heard there really a reflection of the issues that I've been hearing about in Wisconsin over the last 10 days or so, just from those two voters talking about the economy, about immigration, and of course about abortion as well. And as we heard there, quite a nuanced view, not necessarily everyone believes that Donald Trump is going to be bad for women's rights. Certainly that Republican voter said she wasn't. One other interesting point about this election, people are looking back at what happened 4 years ago, all those concerns about voter integrity. Here in this district, they told us that they used to have, 4 years ago at least, drop boxes, which are these boxes in the streets where people who vote early could actually physically drop off their envelopes. This year, they decided not to do that because they were worried about security, and they've said, actually, that feels justified because there have been a few cases in the last few weeks of drop boxes being set on fire in certain American states. So just gives you a flavour of the anxiety, not just around who wins this election, but on the process of the election itself.
There you go. I knew you could do it, Jamie. Thank you so much for that. For the time being, James Kamara-Samy there, live in Wisconsin. Let's head to another swing state now. And this is being seen as the big prize to win tonight. It's Pennsylvania. It's got 19 electoral college votes, as Jamie was talking about there. It's pretty crucial, really, for any candidate wanting to get to the White House. We can cross live to Philadelphia now, and our correspondent Anna Foster is there. Anna, how would you describe the mood in Philadelphia?
It's a real mix, actually. What I have seen is a lot of voter engagement this morning. The lines at the polling stations have been long and they have been consistent. I was up and out even before the doors opened this morning. And those lines have not settled. People are waiting. They're waiting patiently to cast the ballots. Those of them who haven't done mail-in ballots already, 1.8 million mail-in ballots in this state. But there's also, I think, a sense of trepidation and nervousness, particularly after what happened here last time round. This state voted for Joe Biden in 2020, Donald Trump in 2016. But last time round, Donald Trump questioned the vote here, questioned the integrity of the vote. Mm. And people still remember that happening. They're nervous as well about whether or not the result will be respected, I think, by the campaigns and their supporters as well. In fact, there was two women I was talking to last night at a cheesesteak place right here in the centre of Philly, and they said that they feared riots on the street. Now, there's a very sort of strong concern, and not everybody is sort of feeling quite as apocalyptic as that about it, but there is certainly a nervousness about what might ensue in the next few days, particularly I think if it turns out to be tight.
Yeah, Anna, I mean, the authorities are prepared for that, aren't they? Because we heard earlier from Philadelphia's district attorney Larry Krasner, this is the message he had for anyone planning to disrupt the electoral process.
Anybody who thinks it's time to insult, to deride, to mistreat, to threaten people, F around and find out. We do have the cuffs, we do have the jail cells, we do have the Philly juries, and we have the state prisons. So if you're going to try to turn an election into some form of coercion, if you're going to try to bully people, bully votes or voters, you're going to try to erase votes, you're going to try any of that nonsense, we're not playing.
District Attorney Larry Krasner there with a very strong message, Anna.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, trying to sort of consider the scope of who he might be addressing there. You know, everybody from people on the street right up to the campaigns themselves, I would say. I mean, he talked about insults, and we've seen plenty of those thrown around, even just in the last few days towards the end of the campaign, and particularly from Donald Trump's side, that sort of very anti-establishment rhetoric that he comes out with that is so, so popular among his supporters. They see it as this absolute breath of fresh air. But on the other side, they see it, you know, sort of straying into playground insult territory at times. But you're right. I mean, Pennsylvania is the place they want to make it really clear that this will not be a quick result. The way that they count their ballots, the way that they start processing the mail-in ballots only today means it will take a few days. Okay. It won't be a fast result. I think they're preparing people for that because they know that this is the place that all eyes will be on, as you said, those 19 electoral college votes that both sides are desperate for.
All right. For the time being, Anna Foster in Philadelphia, thank you very much indeed. Don't forget, there's full coverage of the results in a special programme on the World Service tonight. It starts at 22 GMT, that's 5 p.m. Eastern. Coming up later in the programme, could the advancing space age involve wood? We speak to one of the scientists in Japan who's made the world's first wooden satellite.
Wood is something which, of course, would not seem an obvious choice for space. And yet, I think when the scientists first started to tackle this, they just turned it around and they said, why not? It turned out that the Magnolia piece actually didn't exhibit any kind of damage whatsoever. And this very much surprised the scientists.
More on that to come. And of course, our main headline this hour and probably much of the day, Americans are voting in what's being described as the most consequential election in a generation, with Kamala Harris hoping to become the first female president. Much also hinges on races for the Senate and, of course, the House of Representatives too. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. What's happened to the Iranian woman who was detained after removing her clothes on Azad University campus in Tehran at the weekend? In what looks like it might have been a protest, social media clips show the young woman, who's believed to be a student, calmly sitting on a wall wearing only her underwear, then slowly walking along the pavement with her arms folded. This clip we're about to hear has gone viral, and it was filmed by a group of women hiding behind the curtains in one of the classrooms. Just to paraphrase what you can hear them saying there, one woman says, I'm recording her, I've got a clear view. And then her friend, you can just hear, says a warning, if the security guards see you filming, they'll punish you. Well, she was detained shortly after that moment. A spokesperson from the university said she was suffering from a mental disorder, but activists say she was staging a protest at the strict clothing laws after being criticised for the way she was wearing her headscarf by the so-called morality police. Human rights groups are calling for her to be immediately released. A short time ago, I spoke to Jair Gol from BBC Persian. He told us what we know.
What we know so far, we don't know her name. We don't know who she is, why she was doing this. From the officials, obviously, she was snatched that day, and they say she has been taken to a mental health clinic. And even today, the spokesperson for Iranian government officially, for the first time just hour ago, she said she had some sort of mental disorder. It's not political or security issue. It is more of a social issue, and she has been treated in hospital.
So that's an interesting point, because we have heard that before, haven't we, in similar circumstances?
Absolutely. In the past, most of the time when women protest, even simply removing headscarf, many of them have been treated as they have a mental issue. And even in some cases, their family, relatives, husband, parents have been forced to go on television to say, oh, she had a problem, mental problem. That's why she was doing this kind of thing or going against a cultural norm or Islamic draconian law imposed on Iranian women in 4 decades, how they should cover up. And what we are hearing about this woman is actually, it's obviously, they say one of the militias in the university have attacked her. There was a confrontation between them and in protest. She has removed her clothes, and you have seen the footage. Calmly, she's walking on the pavement. But in the past, as we say, many prisoners inside the prison has been taken to clinic, treated as with mental health patient. But in the end, that wasn't the case.
But of course, the authorities and indeed the people will be very aware of what happened a couple of years ago when a similar situation happened, when a woman was detained. She died in custody. There were mass protests around the country. Are there concerns that there could be protests following this arrest?
I think the Iranian government learned from that incident. The Kurdish Iranian woman, Mahsa Jina Amini, was killed simply for a few of her being out and her clothes deemed to be inappropriate. I think they are very cautious. That's why they are guarding the information. They don't say whether she is detained or she is in hospital. And there is no transparency. When it's come to transparency, when it's come to trust, absolutely the Iranian government is in the bottom of the list of the Iranian people.
And that was Jaya Gol there from BBC Persian. In a few minutes, we'll be hearing from Valencia, Spain, where 1 week on from catastrophic flash floods, the recovery operation continues. What happened in Spain is being seen as another freak weather incident, which, as we know, seem to be happening more frequently. Climate scientists warn that this is just the beginning. Well, earlier, I spoke to American writer Jeremy Rifkin. His new book, Planet Aqua, argues that we need to change the entire way we look at water. He recently said Europe was at the center of the water crisis, and I asked him why.
Europe is actually ground zero, if you will. It's the most endangered right now for global climate. But let me be clear, every continent on this planet is now threatened in the same way. What's happening here is our planetary hydrosphere, which animates all the life on this Earth, is rebelling in the wake of global warming emissions. So what we're beginning to see here is this. For every 1 degree Celsius that the temperature rises on this planet from global warming emissions, the atmosphere is sucking up 7% more precipitation, because the heat from global warming emissions means that we're getting more evaporation of the waters from the oceans, the lakes, the rivers, the soil, the plants, the trees. So that evaporation is moving into the clouds. So we're getting more concentrated precipitation in the clouds and wild water events, blockbuster winter snows, massive spring floods, devastating summer heat waves and wildfires and droughts, and then fall hurricanes. we're waking up to the reality that we live on a water planet, not a land planet. This is going to change the entire way we think of the future for our species. Let me be clear. You may recall back in 1972, our astronauts from the Apollo mission were heading to the moon. And as they got near the moon, one of the astronauts had a little home camera and shot a photo of the planet that we live on from outer space. And what they found shocked them. We thought we would see a green planet, very verdant and green. What the photo showed is it was a blue planet. And that was the first recognition that we live on a water planet, not a land planet. And that changes the whole way we think about the playbook, how we organize the economy, how we educate our kids, how we develop governance, et cetera. So this is a big shift going on.
On the subject of Europe, I mean, clearly people that live in the Sahel, in Africa, in Australia, you know, other parts of the world that have had terrible cyclones and hurricanes recently. Just to kind of clarify why you're pinpointing Europe.
It's not just the Mediterranean-based European countries like Italy, France, Spain. What's happening in Germany, in Central and Northern Europe, is the same thing. This is happening across the continent. For every 1 degree Celsius the temperature goes up, we're going to get more heat waves and droughts and wildfires and flooding.
So obviously there are attempts to keep the temperatures down, to try to halt climate change. That's one big thing that's going on. I don't know how successful we are being at that at the moment. But then the other thing we need to do, hearing what you say, is adapt to the climate change. And with regard to water, what do we need to be doing with water or about water to manage it better?
The problem is we've gotten it wrong for a long time, really about 6,000 years since the beginning, what we call urban hydraulic civilizations. And so it began in Mesopotamia. Kids learned this in school. And then we had the great rivers being sequestered in the Indus Valley of India, and then later in China, and then in Southeast Asia, and then across the Roman Empire, all the way to today, with these great hydroelectric power dams all over the world. And what's happening now, because the climate is changing, the hydrosphere is actually rewilding and looking for a new normal. So it's choosing the new ecosystems. It's choosing where the planet goes. That means, as you said, that our species, like the others, have to adapt to the hydrosphere rather than adapting the hydrosphere to us. And we have to see the watery planet we live in as a life source, not a resource. These are big changes, which means that we are on the cusp of rethinking everything, our governance, our economy, the way we organize our life. For example, what happened in Valencia, that's quite important, but it's happening in every region. So we're going to have to move to what we call bioregional governance. We're not giving up nations, but they're going to have to extend their political boundaries, because we're finding out that climate disasters don't honor political boundaries. So in bioregional governance, we share preparation, restoration, and recovery across these boundaries.
And that was Jeremy Rifkin, writer of the new book Planet Aqua, speaking to us earlier today. Welcome back to NewsHour. Earlier, we were hearing about the importance of managing water. Well, this is at the top of the agenda in Spain at the moment. It's still looking for missing people after the catastrophic flash floods in Valencia a week ago. At least 217 people were killed and hundreds of homes and businesses all but destroyed. Our Europe correspondent Bethany Bell has this report on the challenging clean-up operation.
I'm in a park near the Turia River in Valencia, in front of an ever-growing mound of debris. Bulldozers and pickup trucks are bringing the contents of people's homes. Mud-stained mattresses, fridges, ovens, all destroyed, ruined in the mud and water.
There was water in houses. People don't have where to stay.
Close by, I met Kautar, a student, covered in mud. She's one of thousands of volunteers helping to clean up people's homes. She told me it's difficult work.
It's so sad, horrible. Like, you see people crying, people lost their homes, some people that lost family.
Yeah.
They need some help, because it's not normal to wake up and find that your neighbors are dead.
Thousands of soldiers, police and emergency workers are here as part of what Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has called the biggest peacetime deployment in his country's history. Jorge is from the Spanish Marines.
The catastrophe is big.
What are you doing?
Only cleaner, 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 cleaner.
Businesses have been hit hard too. Bus Motor, a small company which sells cleaning products online, has its warehouse in Picanha, one of the worst affected areas close to Valencia. Its press officer, Diego Navarro Rodriguez, says they've lost almost all their stock.
First, we need to get the mud out of the warehouse. From there, see how we can recover and how the central Spanish government and aid agencies are responding. At the moment, nothing much is getting through.
It will take weeks, if not months, before the extent of the damage is clear. Diego, another volunteer, says he's been helping in Paiporta, where dozens of people died.
People that live there are very grateful that we go help them. They need help, our help. So they are very grateful, yeah. In fact, we helped one woman and she was crying and very helpful, telling us that we did a very great job.
Bethany Bell with that report. And in the past couple of hours, Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has announced that $11 billion of aid and reconstruction measures will be promised to Valencia and other areas hit by those devastating flash floods a week on. There's more on this story on the BBC website. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby, and let's head back to the States now. And I noticed that shares in Donald Trump's social media company are up. Trump Media and Technology Group, which owns Truth Social, surged by 12% yesterday, which I suspect is being seen by his supporters as an indication that he's going to win. Donald Trump was campaigning late into the night in Michigan yesterday. He's back in Palm Beach, Florida now. We're anticipating he's going to cast his ballot imminently, it seems. His running mate, J.D. Vance, has just voted in his home city of Cincinnati, Ohio. In the past 30 minutes or so, he was asked by reporters what message he had for voters who won't get the election result they want today.
We do expect to win, but obviously no matter who wins, half the country, as you said, is going to be at least partially disappointed. I think my attitude is the best way to heal the rift in the country is to try to govern the country as well as we can, create as much prosperity as we can for the American people, and remind our fellow Americans that we are all fundamentally on the same team, however we voted.
J.D. Vance speaking a few minutes ago. Well, let's cross live to Palm Beach, and our correspondent Will Grant is there with a good view of the polling station, I think. Will?
Yeah, that's right, Rebecca. I can see right to the front door where we're expecting Donald Trump to appear in the coming minutes. It's a pretty blowy day, that's for sure. There's a tropical storm heading towards Cuba, which is, of course, just 90 miles off this coast. So, you know, there's a sort of stormy feeling to this morning. But Donald Trump has put out a tweet and on his own social media site that you mentioned, Truth Social, where he sort of made an 11th hour urge to his supporters to turn out and vote too. He called it the most important day in American history. Voter enthusiasm is through the roof, he said, because people want to make America great again. He urged them to stay in the lines no matter how long it takes, saying that the Democrats wanted people to go back and pack up and go home. But of course, he will be delivering his own vote pretty shortly. And then we expect him to make a similar comments to the media on his way out.
Well, it sounds pretty lively where you are, Will. And we just heard the helicopters overhead there. I guess security must be pretty tight there today.
Yeah, it is. There have been obviously a lot of Secret Service sniffer dogs. There's security all around this particular area. Of course, all around his residence, Mar-a-Lago, around the convention center where he's having his watch-along party once the votes tallies start rolling in. And yeah, there are supporters here. There's kind of quite a lively atmosphere. A lot of journalists, as you can imagine, cameras and reporters and so on, photographers. And I think the sort of spirit that this thing is finally reaching D-Day, as it were. It's gotten to this point. It's been a long and exhausting, at times grueling campaign for both candidates. And now the moment of truth arrives.
And Will, I mean, Florida used to be something of a swing state, isn't it? Those old enough might remember the 2000 election and the ghostly hanging Chad dispute that happened around then. Now it seems it is firmly behind Mr. Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of morphed over recent years, really since Donald Trump burst onto the scene in 2016. I would say a lot of recent arrivals to the Cuban-American and the Venezuelan-American community have quite a lot to do with that. Those who've lived in Cuba, lived in Venezuela, and are staunchly against anything that smacks of socialism have really delivered this state and the 30 electoral college votes it represents to Donald Trump on the past two occasions, and I expect this to be the third. Previously, you're right, it's voted both for George W. Bush and for Barack Obama. I think those days are over, and that this is now a state that he can pretty much count on. His presence here as a resident has a lot to do with it. They see him as one of their own.
All right, well, for the time being, Will Grant there in Palm Beach, Florida, with an incoming storm, it seems, and also Donald Trump's arrival imminent for his vote. Thank you very much for now. Well, right through this campaign, there's been allegations of fake news and disinformation. Social media has been inundated with material that the US intelligence agencies say they suspect foreign actors to have been distributing. Well, this is one video that went viral in recent days. It falsely shows an individual who claims he's from Haiti, and he says he voted in Georgia.
We came to America 6 months ago, and we already have an American citizenship. We're voting Kamala Harris. Yesterday we voted in Gwinnett County, and today we're voting in Fulton County.
Well, BBC Verify has been studying this issue for months, and reporter Cheyenne Sardarzadeh told us about the kinds of videos they've been investigating.
From the moment we started tracking this campaign earlier in the year, most of the videos were sort of in line with Russia's interest in Ukraine. So they were anti-Ukraine, pro-Kremlin. But in the last couple of months, we've noticed that there's been attack towards targeting the US election campaign. And specifically, they're trying to make these videos to pretend like the BBC or Fox News or Sky News or ABC or CBS are saying that America is a country near collapse, that sort of the election is so dysfunctional, that there's widespread voter fraud. All of those things that are sort of supposed to sow discord in the US, that's the era that they're targeting.
Right. And so they're very convincing then in terms of the way that they're presented. And just expand a bit more on the messaging. What sort of people do they seem to be trying to target?
Well, because the videos are in English, obviously the target seems to be, and because many of them specifically are about the US and the election campaign, they seem to be targeted at people in the United States in particular. And they're sort of banking on the idea that people see these videos and believe them, and basically they cause sort of unrest or mistrust of authorities. Kamala Harris specifically also is targeted, and her husband, Douglas Emhoff, are sort of targeted in some of these videos.
And so you said that the US intelligence services believe they have evidence that it is coming from Russia. What is the solid evidence that that's the source?
US intelligence agencies together issued a joint statement, and they said that they have evidence from sort of previous activities, and also obviously there's stuff that they're not going to share with us. But they say that they have some level of confidence based on past monitoring and sort of pattern of behavior that this operation arises from Russia. Now, we also made the same conclusion when we were looking at this operation check, working with our colleagues at fact-checking organization Logically and Finnish investigative organization Check First. They also believe they have spotted IPs and that are based in Russia.
And Cheyenne, is it possible to know whether people believe these videos and whether they will make a difference, perhaps in this election?
Well, that is actually really difficult to say. What I can tell you is these videos, when you look at them, some of them in particular that have a sort of very well-made narrative, they're actually, it's not really that easy to spot that these are fake and these are not like real videos made by these news outlets, unless you go and check their websites, their social media accounts and see, you know, they've never posted this stuff. So it is possible, but thankfully, I think from what we've seen so far, the videos have actually failed to get that much engagement. You know, a handful of them have gone viral, and most of them actually haven't got that much attention. The videos that we're a bit more worried about, which is like not part of this operation, you know, in the last week or so, we have seen three specific videos targeting three of the key battleground states in the US, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Arizona. One in Pennsylvania was supposed to show one poll worker basically tearing apart mail-in ballots for Donald Trump. One in Georgia was supposed to show two Haitians illegally voting in Georgia. And another one in Arizona was supposed to show the Arizona Secretary of State being involved in a massive voter fraud operation. And all of these three videos, the US intelligence agencies also believe are the work of Russian influence actors. But the difference here is that these three videos have actually gone viral. Like a lot of people have unfortunately seen them, have been sharing them. And that's why very quickly US intelligence has come down and said these videos are fake.
Shayan Zardari Zadeh there from BBC Verify. Now, could the advancing space age actually involve wood, probably humankind's first building material? Scientists from Japan have developed a tiny satellite about the size of a human hand, and it's made from magnolia wood. They've launched it from the International Space Station and plan to investigate how it responds to the hostile environment of space. I've been speaking to David Hajime Kornhauser from Kyoto University, who told us why wood.
Wood is something which, of course, would not seem an obvious choice for space. And yet, I think when the scientists first started to tackle this, they just turned it around and they said, why not? And part of it is because they were thinking about looking for building materials in space. If you think about going out to the moon or Mars and making something, of course, there are rocks and sand and other things that you can get locally. But then if you want to make something that people feel comfortable in, wood actually turns out to be something that people would want to feel, want to have around them. And so the idea was, well, then maybe if we grow wood, for example, in hothouses or something, could we actually use it? Would it be viable? So that led them to sending sample wood pieces to the International Space Station several years ago. And they exposed these to the environment in Earth orbit. And they brought the samples back after 10 months and they tested them. And they were quite surprised to find that most of the wood pieces actually survived very well.
Goodness. Okay, so this particular satellite's been made out of magnolia wood.
Exactly.
I wonder why that is. And also talk us through some of the extreme environments it's going to have to go through.
Yes. Of the different samples that they sent up, it turned out that the magnolia piece actually didn't exhibit any kind of damage whatsoever. And this very much surprised the scientists. They were expecting to find at least something. I mean, of course, very obviously, you could imagine micrometeorites. But then there are all sorts of other things, like there's outgassing, which means that there are gas bubbles trapped in the wood that would then escape because of the very low atmosphere of space. And this would cause cracking. In the shadow behind the Earth, it would be on the order of minus 100, for example, just completely cold. Nothing is moving. But that didn't happen in the case of magnolia.
So this is obviously very small. But is the idea that we could see larger craft made out of wood operating in space?
That is the hope, actually. If it's possible to take the pieces into space or take the entire vessel into space.
And is the idea with this linked to the concern about the amount of space junk that we've now got circling the Earth at any given time? And perhaps something like wood might be a more sustainable option for, you know, more activity in space.
Yes, definitely. When it comes to the end of cycle for one of these crafts in orbit, it would definitely burn up much more cleanly and much more completely than if it were entirely made out of metal. Of course, there is metal there. The electronics inside, there's a bit of a frame around the outside that's needed in order to launch the vehicle from the ISS platform. But the amount of material that is needed to make it is substantially more wood than metal in this case. And potentially that could reduce the amount of waste in space.
David Hajime Kornhauser there. And a reminder of our top story this hour. Voting is underway in the US presidential elections with Trump and Harris neck and neck in the polls. NewsHour's James Kumarasamy spoke to one voter in Wisconsin just after she cast her vote.
Yeah, I was raised in a Republican household, and in my younger years, I voted Republican.
So it was Donald Trump, was it, that turned you away from the party?
It wasn't Donald Trump. It was the party itself was changing. But, I mean, Donald Trump put the nail in the coffin. There's no doubt about that.
Other headlines this hour. Spain's prime minister has pledged $11 billion to rebuild areas devastated by flash flooding last week. And anti-corruption police have been searching the headquarters of the French Football League. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Well, it's been an eventful year in US politics. Who would have predicted this time last year that today's presidential election would be between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris? There have been many twists in the road on this campaign. Joe Biden dropping out, Donald Trump surviving two assassination attempts, the trash talk both sides, and lots more in between. Here's some of the highlights and indeed lowlights.
Every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do with the dealing with everything we have to do with look.
With faith and devotion, I proudly accept your nomination for President of the United States. And take a look at what happened.
And I said, let Trumpomania run wild, brother.
I accept your nomination to be President of the United States of America.
I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black.
You know it, you feel it. These guys are creepy and, yes, just weird as hell. That's what you see. That's what you see.
If they want to call me weird, I'm a normal guy who wants to live the American dream and wants all of you and your kids to be able to live the American dream. That's why I'm in it. If those people want to call me weird, I think it's a badge of honor.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets.
We are so happy to be standing here on this stage as proud country Texas women.
We are not going back.
Well, to look back at the campaign now and ahead to what direction the United States might take next, I've been speaking to Gary Gerstle. Gerstle, he's Professor of American History at the University of Cambridge. So with this election being billed as the most consequential in generations, where does it sit in the arc of American history?
It's enormously consequential. If Trump wins today, and given his own skepticism about abiding by the rule of law and supporting democratic forms of government, it may be that the U.S. is passing out of its democratic phase. On the other hand, the Democrats under Kamala Harris have a vision, a quite hopeful one. The divergence between the two parties at this point could hardly be more extreme. And in that sense, it is an extraordinarily consequential election that will set the path of America for at least the next 5 to 10 years.
So what do you think has gone wrong then, not just in politics, but with the whole establishment? Is it broken? And what's led to that? How did we get here?
Well, that's a long and deep story. And I should say as well that the story in America is not unique to America. It's a global story. And your listeners around the world will recognize that authoritarian impulses are strong in a lot of places. I think it reflects the difficulty of life in the 21st century, beginning with the great financial crash of 2008-2009, which exposed the lies of the reigning economic orthodoxy of the time, known as neoliberalism, that it would raise all boats and bring economic development to everyone in the world. And what was exposed by that financial crash is that there were winners and losers, and the losers felt their loss very keenly and very deeply and took their anger out in politics. And Trump's first election in 2016 was a symptom of that, as was Brexit, as was Modi, Orban. And then I think in the effort to forge our way away from an economic system that valorizes free markets above all else, politicians and people have had difficulty finding their way to a new system that generates widespread support. And then I think we can't underestimate the pain of COVID. It's remarkable to me how little COVID is being talked about in this campaign, but a million Americans dying, families and children suffering, the inflation that was unleashed as part of an effort to propel an economy that had been brought to a standstill. And so people experienced a level of inflation that they had not experienced in 50 years. People have a sense of tremendous volatility, uncertainty, and fear without a clear direction going forward. And that lends itself to not trusting traditional mechanisms of governance and putting yourself in the hands of a strong man who promises to quickly settle accounts.
And so if Harris does win, is that the end of Trump? And is that the end of Trumpism?
It is the end of Trump. American politics doesn't like losers. And if he loses today, that will be his fourth loss in the sense of 2018 midterms, the 2020 presidential election, the 2022 midterms, and he will be finished. But the forces unleashed by Trump are not going away. And here again, we have to think about the international context. These forces are present in many areas of the world now. There are people in the Republican Party who are deeply committed to forms of Trumpism. He also has been trying to make the Republican Party into something other than it had been, with a populist base appealing to the working class. What is unclear is who can take Trump's place. It's hard to imagine another political figure dominating the political landscape as Trump has done.
We were hearing earlier in the program about various disinformation campaigns that have been going on throughout this election cycle. Over the past few years, how much has that impacted politics? And also, where has the established media lost the trust and why?
Well, if we put the traditional broadcast media within an establishment very much implicated in a neoliberal worldview, a cosmopolitanism, a favoring of a certain set of cultural attitudes, I think the traditional media is guilty in some respects of ignoring the people and needs of those living in what in America is often called flyover territory. And I think also here the decay of local newspapers has been very important, and its replacement by social media, I think, has not been healthy for processes of democratic deliberation. And also, I think the fact that social media institutions are in the hands of extraordinarily rich and powerful individuals, and here Elon Musk and Twitter is a prime example of this, is a very troubling development. The U.S. has had a very robust history of public regulation of utilities, understood to mean those forms of communication so important that they cannot entirely be left in private hands. And that history has been completely abandoned. If the United States is to recover its democratic health, it is going to have to engage in a kind of public regulation of media that returns it to the roots it established and the patterns it embraced 150 years ago.
Professor Gary Gerstle there. Don't forget, special coverage tonight starting at 22 hours GMT. Roz Atkins and Nuala McGovern with a special program, America Decides. That's 5 p.m. Eastern. From us, that's it. Thanks for listening.